Hello, my name is Armin Alic. Thank you for tuning in to Talking Spirits. It is a huge pleasure and honor to introduce to you my first guest, the American artist, activist, albinist, and alchemist Mem Nahat, also known as M. M and I have been friends for many years and have spent lots of time together, be it on the road or in the recording studio, playing music together, or just on the phone, talking. Besides of being my favorite female vocalist of all times, M's perspective on life is a truly unique one, and I'm very grateful to say that I have learned a lot from her over the years in many different regards. You have already heard M's one-of-a-kind voice in the Talking Spirits jingle, and the conversation you're about to listen to was recorded in the very late hours of April 20th, 2020. We are covering a vast area of topics, and we hope that you will enjoy listening as much as we enjoy talking. Ladies and gentlemen, Mem Nahat. Hi, Em. Welcome to the Talking Spirits podcast. I'm very happy that you are my guest today and you're taking the time to do it.
Hi, Armin. I am really happy, excited, and honored for you to think of me to participate with you. This is going to be so much fun.
Em, you are an artist, an activist, an albinist, and an alchemist. In a way, these are very different identities. Which one of them defines you the most?
An artist takes the resources they have at hand and creates a close proximity to the beauty that they know and love. An activist takes the circumstances that they have in hand and tries to create a condition of beauty and love as close as they can. An albinist takes being born with albinism and creates a beautiful world with their albinism included, revering it and living a life of beauty as an albinist to the best they can. An alchemist takes whatever resource they have at hand and with their knowledge of the sameness of the universe, turns the resources that they have led into the beauty that they want. Gold. They're all the same.
Let's start with talking albinism.
Okay.
So being born of African-American parents, but with white skin and blonde hairs, I could imagine it gives you a very unique perspective on life, on the world, and the society we are living in. So how would be your take on describing it?
Perfect the art of standing upside down or being upside down and standing on your hands and walking around, and you'll have my perspective of living given my life condition of having the genetic condition called albinism. Both of my parents are of the dark chocolate variety, beautiful, translucent, and I was born with naturally blonde hair and skin fairer than the Caucasian. And that perspective that you create or that develops out of that being is the depth of understanding of how sane the human race is in its diversity. It's all the same. The question of equality and validity is completely answered. It blows away all premises of determining someone based on the color of their skin. That it melts it away to the nothingness that that mentality actually is. And enjoying and realizing that in my life has given me ability to stay steady in my mind despite whatever would happen, when most people don't even see the division of you based on your gender or the color of your skin. Most people just judge you by what you look like and don't even realize what's going on. Now, that's something that they consider because I don't have to.
Would you be willing to talk about your experiences? I mean, I'm thinking of one song which you wrote, the song You Stare, where I, at least the way I perceive it, you also talk about about this topic.
Yeah, well, you know, you stare is sort of a double entendre. It's about a person speaking to their lover when their lover could be staring at them based on being emotionally enamored with the love that they're looking at. And it also speaks about when you're stared at. For whatever reason, I just happen to have one of the more convenient reasons of albinism with really, really kinky hair. So you're going like, what is that? So often I don't even make it to ethnicity. I barely get off the petri dish of scientific, what the hell? But you stare speaks to your lover, and it also speaks to the society we engage in with every day. And you stare, and I just wonder, you know, if I actually want to give a shit about what you're thinking, which I kind of rarely do, which is also an aspect of being so vitally different. You're really directed to know your own mind and heart and not worry about whether or not you belong, because that question is decidedly answered when you look in the mirror. But that song was a very subtle way of saying the same thing. You stare and I wonder, what are you staring about? What are you thinking while you're staring? Just opening that up. But it was really intended to be a love song of, I know you love me. I know you're looking at me with loving eyes. What are you thinking? But you really would only ask that as an intimate question to somebody you really love and care about.
If we talk about being an artist, among the many things I find very fascinating, there's one, and it's the fact that if I'm informed correctly, you started your professional music career at the age of 35. So my question would be, firstly, how and when were you introduced into the world of music? And secondly, what prompted your decision to go for it at the age of 35?
Okay, well, let's see. I was introduced into the world of music probably at 3 or 4 because of my childhood memories. I can remember being sensitive to wonderful things that I heard at 3 or 4. At 3 or 4, that would have been because of my environment. Music that had glorious chord changes or soulful singing that was broadcast on the radio, because that's all I would have had access to back then. But the chord changes in Stevie Wonder's My Sharia Moore, or as I got older, the chord changes in Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, those arrangements and chord changes, my young childish ears were actually sensitive to. I gave no regard or a focus to the children's songs, you know, Wheels on the Bus and crazy children's fun children's songs like that. But the grown-up songs you heard on the radio, and that I became and grew to become sensitive to. It's not like my mom and dad ever had a collection of albums, not a large one. But my mom did have some gospel albums that she loved and that she played regularly. And that would be my introduction to what Southern blues bands did, Muddy Waters type. But because they were indoctrinated into the Christian faith, they would play for God, but they would still play mad, amazing blues guitar and singing blues. And they just made it sure that it was orthodox for the religion, but it was still badass, and I was still sensitive to those. That's how I grew into loving music. My mom and I attended a parent-teachers meeting at the school in my classroom in kindergarten, and they were over in the corner discussing me, how the student's doing, and et cetera, and so on. And by the time I would pick at the piano in the corner, it was first fascinating to me because we weren't allowed to touch it when we were in class. And I finally got to mess around with it. And what happened was I noticed that the whole room got quiet. And they were just a moment ago discussing and talking in the corner, maybe giggling and laughing and lady to lady talk. And I was playing the piano. But then the room was quiet. And I wondered, okay, that was decidedly different to me. What's going on? I looked around and my teacher and my mom were staring at me with their mouths open. Apparently, as I'm told by my mom, I was picking out a melody, not something that was recognizable, but just a coherent succession of notes, a melody on the piano, made it up in the moment just to pass the time. And that's when they realized they should probably get me into music class. That's back when we had music class in public schools in America, but they should probably get me into music class. And in music class, I learned basic general first page of the book theory. And my music teacher, after a couple of years, from 5 years old to 12 years old, I studied in public schools. And then when I was 12, she had me enrolled in the local conservatory, where I learned deeper theory and composition and all the basics still, because I had to leave the conservatory. And then the rest of my musical endeavors was deep listening, but developing my ear based on what I was vibrated to listen to. And so just the love of music happened from 17 to 35, life. So I'd have something to write about. 35, desperation, because I needed somebody to talk to that I could write about. And so at 35, it was like, this isn't working for me, whatever the circumstances of this was in my life. And I decided to try my hand at music writing again and fell in headfirst to the deep end of the pool and dedicated myself. In the meantime, I had attended college, got married, had children, you know, life. But then by 35, I really had something to write about. And once again, it wasn't Mickey Mouse trying to be a star. I wanted to make an art of what I was so deeply moved by.
But then in 1999, you released your first solo work called Madwoman, a Contemporary Opera. If you can talk about it, what led you to the decision to go out on your own? And what do you think of when you remember the times when you were creating the album?
Well, let me answer the latter first. Creating the album, what I thought about was the freedom I'd had because of the situation I'd found myself in and was able to create this album. I was in a place of a lot of love and freedom. The person I was working with, my current partner, James P. Nichols, and had created an environment where misogyny wasn't a part of it. He was excited when I wanted to know, and I was deeply wanting to know because what he was doing was exciting. So that exchange was really, really strong and equal. So because I was in an environment where I was free, I could express freely and was proud of the things that I was expressing at that moment. I started writing music and producing poetry to the music and singing and developing my craft while I was a housewife and a mother of three. As I grew, I became more known in my community, local community. One thing about my work was I started privately and really never stepped out of that circle because I couldn't find anybody else that was on the same page. And so I didn't bother to entertain whether or not they could get on my page. I really kept it moving. And having albinism, I developed the first 35 years of my life. I know what it was like to be a loner. So that didn't bother me at all to do it all on my own, at all whatsoever. So I basically didn't work with people, didn't join a group or do anything like that because they weren't vibrating where my head was. When I met James Nichols in New York, he was an engineer. He wasn't writing for me or with me. He was an engineer. He had the one aspect of the thing I could not do and many decades of it. So he was the expert when I met him. He's grown, we both grown since because the mediums have grown, you know, from vinyl to CD to digital tracks, etc. But he knew what he was doing and I could not do that. So there grew a partnership of equal exchange. I gave him something to record and he recorded it beautifully. Before then, nobody crossed my path that attracted me to want to work together. So going out on my own started at day one. Putting the album out on my own was easy. After watching A-list stars run to Congress to speak about how unfair and slave-like their recording contracts were in the late 90s. So you can imagine what happened in the development of a recording contract with a major recording label in 2020. So the thought of giving that over never occurred. It was no way. It did occur because people would say, why don't you go get signed? Why don't you go get signed? And for me, it was like, to who, for what? I would never, because of stories of colleagues, I already knew they weren't going to give me production freedom. They're definitely going to give me styling freedom. They're going to get into messing around with the words I want to say and express. So my artistry was always in my heart and in my mind and from me. And so the best you could do was help me enhance it and expose it. And a recording engineer is going to definitely enhance what the musical artist, I'm a performance artist because my artistry is in the performing of it. Mr. Nichols is a recording artist as opposed to a producer engineer because his expertise is getting it down, recording it. So I sort of flip those titles, but that's the way we operate. It never occurred to me to join up with anything that wasn't vibrating like I did. And it was easy for me to avoid labels and say no to any labels. I've been approached, but it was easy to avoid it because of all of the stories of others. And I know everybody handles their business differently, but it seemed to be the same old story over and over again, even with righteous people that I knew.
It still is. And how great that you could have this knowledge, which was shared with you by others at that point in time, because from what many others go through, you know, they need a lot of time to find out things like this. And it's not only time, but involves like a lot of pain and disappointment. And
yeah, and my pop tolerance for pain is real low. A paper cut is like a sword through me through and through. It's real low. I do not purposely choose to just try to really work hard and it'll come. Smart is much better for me. I have an example, if you would bear with me. In this age of a global pandemic, I have a friend who has managed to create a music video to some tracks they had already recorded, but they can't release the we created a video and people want to buy the track because they were so moved by the video. But she can't sell the track because she and her band are entertaining, not signed, entertaining a deal with a major record label. And they don't want to put it out before they sign a deal with the major record label, messing up the record label's plans for their music. So they will get accolades and of course they'll have a waiting audience when it finally gets done. But everything's shut down right now. So that's pretty much going to fall into the indefinite pile of things. And I could not tolerate that, especially since they were able to create a music video that the record label couldn't even get to. And the record label can't even release the fucking MP3. Pardon my French, Spanish, German. The record label can't even release the damn track for sales, which everybody needs right now. It just makes no sense.
yeah, but in the way this example shows, like, you know, when we think about how easy it is to put something online and put it out to people, so that maybe shows like how inflexible those are who have all this big structures and you know.
Exactly.
While it's nowadays really, I mean, we could do a song now, finish it tomorrow, and we could put it on and we'll be, you know, it would be online within a few days if you want to.
Absolutely. And that's just a music track. We did a music video and a documentary about doing the music video, not being able to see, touch, or be with each other because of the quarantines. We did all of that, put it out into the world. We're getting subscribers and views now, and they cannot release a single MP3 track because of the inflexibility of the structure of the corporation, which has not much room for creative ways of exercising business practices. And that's probably what has kept me choosing to be on my own as an independent. The tools that are developed now in 2020 are not the tools that were available to us in 1999, save email
and
posting. So I'm simply, as an independent, using the tools that are available to us that are now being used by corporate. You know, that's a flip. So why am I running to you to do something I can very easily and handily do on my own? However, you've got such a large market share. That's what may entice those who are interested. That market share is really strong. It means sales. It means notoriety. And it's important to people. I can't knock that because it's a function. It does very good. It helps musicians make a living. But the structures of the business, of the institutions, of the government, that I don't see any creativity in it at all. And I live for creativity. So c'est la vie.
Yeah. But if we go back to 1999 for a moment, earlier you were talking about enhancement of your artistic vision or of the music. And one part of the enhancement of your first album is the fact that you not only did record the songs and the music, but also you created like a film to the whole album. Could you talk about this for a little bit?
1990, I can't talk about it because we were into creation of the things that people create normally now. And in between that then and now was the area in time where you paid $100,000 for a music video and there was such a thing as MTV. Mm. So people got used to visuals that accompanied the music. Thank you, MTV. So when you put out music, having a visual, even if it was a photo slideshow, was kind of necessary even in 99. Just 2 weeks ago, I had the shock of my life. Of course, that's exaggerated, but I'll describe it. I got an email that YouTube was celebrating its 15th anniversary.
Mm.
I've been putting videos on the internet before that.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, wait a minute, YouTube is only 15 years old. Where the hell have I been putting videos online?
Before.
If I've been doing it before to YouTube was YouTube. What the hell? And then my son reminded me that I used to embed my videos, my .avis, anybody who knows will know, I used to embed them in my website that I had designed for myself to be shown before YouTube even occurred.
Yeah.
And that one for me was like, oh shit, we did. We've embedded our own. Hello, the days of .avis and Real Player.
I remember.
Exactly. So we've been doing it for a long time. And the method of doing it was simply taking the old style camcorder, you know, the small handheld camcorder, and filming neighborhood and filming sites or scenes we would want. The performances, the parties, the neighborhoods, and then editing it together in Vegas.
Yeah.
And making music videos that way. Putting it on our site and embedding it there before YouTube, finding YouTube and starting to do it there. That's how we started. Also, it occurred to me, thinking along those lines, in 1999 or 2000, we had a tripod, two-legged tripod, a camcorder that was broken, a red velvet long piece of material we used to use as a room divider, a broken necklace that no longer could be worn around the neck. And I made my video Beautiful Things with that material. Since evolving, the Brooklyn necklace has become a headpiece. The red piece of fabric that was my backdrop has now become the green screen. The two-legged tripod that was basically broken has become the monopod. And the broken camcorder that couldn't record, but it could stream straight through to the computer to record whatever you're looking at on your hard drive directly, has now become a webcam. So in 2000, we were a little bit ahead of our time because all our shit was broken.
Yeah, you know, but this is also very, very interesting and funny thing, like, how artists like able to work with the limitations
they are,
they are confronted with, and the ability to improvise and just do something with the possibilities you have. And very often it is the case that, like, on this path, things happen which never would have happened if all your equipment would have been the best which was out there at that time. What I find very fascinating about those videos you did in, like, in 99 or 2000, mm-hmm. is, you know, they have a certain aesthetic expression which is very much according to the music, and which is really an enhancement of the musical expression.
Yeah, it just, with each song, I think I became more proactive to the Mad Woman collection of songs to make sure they all had visuals. When I was looking at a Japanese anime that I enjoyed called Marcross Plus, and I was admiring how the creators of the DVD that I was watching had the menu holding page in a perfect loop, so you could just let it play and not even watch the movie, just let the menu play, and it played in a perfect loop, and it was a part of the song I really loved. So I was like, that's absolutely perfect. I was mesmerized. That is absolutely perfect. It loops perfectly. I could just let this play all day. I want to know how to do that. And so with Sony Vegas, SoundForge at the time, came a package called DVD Architect. So I taught myself how to make DVDs. That meant that for my Mad Woman songs, everything needed a visual. So I proceeded to use the means I knew to record myself, throw a lovely piece of fabric at the foot of the bed, aim the camera at me, and lip sync songs, put it in the computer, put beautiful backdrops behind it, and make it a music video. Boom, I have another visual for my DVD. I'm trying to do the whole album. I finished it, learned how to make DVDs, and also learned how to film music videos at home. And just kept doing that every time I had something. And then I'd meet a friend who was a budding videographer or filmmaker, and they'd ask me, can I do do your video? And I would not give any direction and just let them do their thing. But I give subtle direction by making sure what I looked like, my dress, my hair, my costume. So I know that whatever gets directed as they make their version of who I am, I have my say by presenting myself as myself the way I know I want to be. And at first, I wasn't really having much success with that because the operative word there was budding. But, you know, they got to exercise their artistry, and I got to learn what the process is, because it would then again teach me, when I get back at doing my own, how to do it. But because I composed the song, I could put the images together to interpret that song, because I was sensitive to that song.
Yeah, yeah. But so basically the approach is very similar to the one you have in music.
Yep. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But so now we are in 2020, and since 1999 you have released 3 more solo albums. In my opinion, as somebody who has listened to them very often, all of them are defined by your very original style. And the most obvious characteristic is, of course, your voice in all of its beauty and uniqueness. But there's a very original approach to your lyrics and to songwriting and also to production. If you try to look back on the process, how would you describe the development from starting with the first album and ongoing until now?
I would hope that I've evolved, even though the style is just distinctively mine. I hope it's grown stronger and evolved. The method of putting things together has gotten easier as I've become more aware how to do it. I wrote all of my music for Mad Woman, all of the samples, all the loops, I wrote them myself in 1999. Since new software has developed, software that was initially focus towards DJs a la Acid to loops already installed in Pro Music DAW software, like in Logic in its library. I've moved from writing all of my samples and loops myself to using what's in the library to create my musical base, and then inviting friends to play certain pieces and give their feeling, because I respect their abilities, give their feeling and open up and expand the music humanly, and then playing the piano keyboard myself to add certain spices that I want, that I don't have friends who play certain instruments or sounds, digital sounds, that way. So including others in that way, playing more with the library is available to me because they do that now. They didn't do that so much in 99. Being able to put it together faster, being able to develop ideas faster, and have it evolve into a finished piece that I appreciate has just gotten better and faster and stronger for me. But of course, we're all also talking over 20 years for so few of albums, when many artists will do 2 or 3 albums a year, or at least every 5 years, was a matter of being an independent artist. I had a tendency to promote a collection of my work longer because I wasn't of the access to budgets to give that promotion over to PR firms to do for me. So I took the time, took many years to get the music out there, promote it, perform it, and then also gather up inspiration to do another collective when I thought I'd squoze the juice out of that collection of fruit that I created before. So maybe it took me 5-7 years to move on to the next project once I thought I did everything I could for the previous.
Additionally to doing your own work, as you now have described it, you also have worked with many different artists from all over the world and also in many different musical styles. How would you describe those experiences?
Some were absolutely wonderful and some were absolutely not, but equally opposite as educational, that it was just priceless. You couldn't get anywhere else except of having gone through the experience. I honor the music of the works I've made in collaboration with others because I know that I gave my all and I appreciate what I'd done in that instance. And so as I remember what work I've done, because I've done a lot over the years, I try to make sure I represent that as well. The relationships have been good because I've learned in everyone, in everything, in every instance, whether there were negatives, which outweighed the positives. I've learned and I've grown, and it's just gotten more loving and more strong. I learned to understand what it was that I was responding to, and it was the harmonic, the soul, the spirit, ironically talking spirits, the spirit and intent of the creator and the love that the creator was easily able to open up and allow in their creation. I responded to that. So the genre didn't matter and style didn't matter. And even in many cases, notoriety didn't matter. It was the beauty of the harmonic and the soul I heard within the harmonic combinations that I was responding to, which also allowed me to be free in my relationships to whomever I was working with, to be myself, be honest, and to say, hey, here I am fully and openly, or to say, okay, see ya.
This is what music should be about. And it's once again, if we return to, for a little bit, return to the music business, where they have the need to put things into categories and in order they can be able to sell it. But what you said earlier just shows how little to nothing this has to do with the music itself, where the harmony and the love and the vibe a piece of music can radiate is the only thing which actually matters. And not only to us as the ones who do it, but also to the people who listen.
Exactly, proving my point in here and now. If this podcast is to be listened to, the millions of people that I hope come to listen to it, they will remember the time when the entire planet Earth was under siege. And in the midst of that, the entire planet Earth had to shut down its normal activity. And on the entire planet Earth, the creatives were the ones that were able to continue. The farmers and the artists are the ones who can produce. Everybody living any sort of modicum of normalcy has been shut down. That says a lot.
Yeah.
That says an awful lot. And it proves the necessity and the validity of your being, because this has never happened before. We have nothing to compare it to, so we can see exactly what's happening. We don't know what's happening now, but we know that we are shut down indefinitely. And those who can produce right now are the farmers and the artists. And farmers are simply art of the physical land. And that should speak to the logic and the necessity and the validity and the substance of all the things we regard now. And you look at that and you go, okay, makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. But at the same time, given what you just said, it's very astonishing to see, on one hand, to see the value of the process of creation and the results which are emerging from it. And on the other hand, to make the experience how much or how little artists are valued in our society by, let's say, the political system or other structures which are right now the ones who decide about what's happening or what's not happening.
That's true. But in the now of a global pandemic, artistry in general, that used to be poo-pooed and considered not necessary, a luxury, is secondary to whatever is priority, which was going to work making the money, and definitely not supporting art the way it really should be, I think, is proven itself as well to flip around, because you are quarantined. You have nothing else. You must regard some art, dancing, singing, playing, reading, whatever. You have all the time in the world. You have no job to go to. You have no distractions. You have to pursue art in terms of doing it or consuming it. We're consumers of content more than anything these days. In the 70s, they started calling us consumers, but they would only regard to services and things. Now it's intellectual content, and they've grown their consumer capacity, and now they need to be fed because everybody's at home alone and bored. Mm-hmm. So the artist is now not invalid anymore, unnecessary anymore. It's primed to keep you from going crazy.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So all the things that were poo-pooed before have done a 180. Everything has done a 180. You know, conservative thinking, which would ignore the needs of the masses for the needs of the minority means havers, are contracting the virus and having to rethink their position and having to be able to relate now. More than ever, there are crazy flips that are happening in the world because of the circumstances we are under, and we will not be returning to normal.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we can be very curious as to the question how it's going to look after all of this is over at some point. And I agree with the statement that it's definitely not going to be the same anymore. As much as this situation is like challenging, there's also the other side to it. Also offers lots of chances, not only for us artists, but basically for everyone.
Absolutely. Just like the historical event of Katrina for Americans, Mm-hmm. You know, lots of people's lifestyles have had changed after watching and or experiencing the Katrina phenomenon. So hard times have always educated us to the better when we go through them, whether they're small instances of our own personal lives and something overwhelming happening there, or larger instances of a collective experiencing something as one and learning from that experience. So detailed wise, you can't anticipate what it's going to be when this passes, and guaranteed this too shall pass.
Yeah.
All things do. You can't detailed say what it's going to be, but I guarantee generically it will be better.
Your voice spans a range of 6 octaves. When and how did you find out that you were able to do more with your voice than it is usually possible for a human being?
It's a weird story, and I can add from the beginning of it that I thought it happened at one time, and I have just within the 30-day period of time of now realized it happened before and it didn't register. But I was taking a shower to get dressed to go to a very popular open mic in New York that I used to attend on the regular in the early 2000s, and used that time to warm up my voice. During the process of warming up my voice, I hit a note mistakenly that cracked the note. All vocalists know about cracked notes. And I became nervous because I didn't want a cracked voice while I'm getting ready to go on mic at an open mic and embarrass myself in public. So I thought I'd warm myself up good so that when I get ready to sing in about an hour when I get to the club, I'll be in good form. While playing with my voice in the bathroom, I reached for a note again and my voice cracked again, and I became very nervous and concerned. So I decided I was going to power through this, and I went to reach the note that my voice cracked in, and it cracked and stayed in the whistle. So not only that, I reached the esophageal ability to reach the whistle tone, I also fell into the weirdest state of mind possible. I had also fallen unconsciously and unknowingly into circular breathing. So I hit the whistle note and I couldn't stop it. I couldn't stop singing. I couldn't shut down. I couldn't pull back my throat to close it up to just stop singing. It wouldn't stop. I was caught in circular breathing. Now, since I've educated myself and understand what it is, where it came from, and a little bit of how to do it, but it was strange to me. I literally stepped out of the shower, looked into the mirror, looked at myself doing it and unable to stop doing it and going, is that me? Am I possessed? What's going on here? Oh my God, stop it. And it wouldn't stop. It was a good 90 seconds, and that's long,
yeah.
You know, unless you're a swimmer or an avid smoker, which I've, you know, become. But that was a long period of time, and I had no control. But in the meantime, I was holding perfectly straight a whistle tone and a circular breathing motion, which it just extended that pure tone constantly. And I went, oh, my God, that's coming out of me. From that point on, I pursued how I get the breath to come out and hold my voice or hold my throat in a certain way to access my whistles. I practiced and played, mostly played because I'm not good at practice, but played with it and began to learn how to control it and then add it to my music where I thought it was tasteful. Now, I say that story as not the first time I did it, but the first time I was conscious of whistle toning, because I've just received this month 2 tracks that I'd done in 1995 as demos to somebody somebody turned into Sony Music, trying to get a record deal. And I listened to one of the songs and I sing a whistle tone in the turnaround from the verse to the bridge. And I did not remember doing that. That would have been 7 years before the shower incident.
Yeah.
So it's really wild. Apparently, I've wanted to do it since I knew Mini Ripper didn't exist, but I finally got it in the mid-2000s, but did it in the mid-90s. Convoluted.
If we take the word or the term mistake, somebody's going to say, oh, you did something wrong or there was a mistake. What you just told me also shows that things which we could say to be a mistake can lead to something new and to more knowledge or to development of expression.
I wrote a line of poetry in a song, Beautiful Things, and the line says, are we forsaken again or are we mistaken again? And so that has one perspective about mistakes. And another one that I remember and use and grew to really deeply understand was a saying that James Nichols always liked to say is it a flaw or is it a feature?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and the most expensive diamonds are the ones that have the most flaws. Now we call them cuts. You know, but they're described in the diamond world as the amount of flaws they have because they allow the diamond to shine brilliantly because they catch the light at a certain angle that they wouldn't had they not been purposely put there. So, yeah, you have to look at your mistakes and realize that everyone is a seed and seeds grow fruit.
Within all the different types of musical work you have done so far, you did also write lots of music for motion picture movies. When you do something like this, when you write for a movie, is there a difference in the process? I mean, do you approach it differently than you do, like when you, let's say, when you work on a song for an album of your own?
Oh, yes, because that is collaboration, if nothing is that. That is collaboration with the visual and the sonic. I happen to interpret the visuals sonically. So you're really working with someone or something, really, because I regard the thing faster than the person, which may not be all that great, but I respect and regard the thing I'm working with and providing my thing or joining my thing to that. With movies, I consider the scenes and write to the scenes I see presented before me. And that gives me, because it's cinema, a certain expanse that a song would not. Although I've incorporated cinematography or cinematic sonic aspects to my music since working with movies. So that's expanded my music, my listening to the regular album because of what I learned writing from movies. And usually I've been asked to lend my perspective sonically to someone's visual art form, and the invitation and the respect for what they've done allows me to express the way I do.
If you don't mind, I would like to talk a little bit about jazz. So, of course, there's a jazz music as an art form, and not only musically, but also with all of its history and with the way how it emerged and why it emerged. But I'm thinking of a very dear friend of ours who once wrote a song with the title "Jazz is a White Racist Word." The friend I'm talking about is, of course, the Reverend.
Reverend Dame, yes, look, good Lord.
If I'm allowed to ask this question very directly, would you agree with him?
I can't neither disagree or agree because I don't know the depth of history that he may. I know it as a word in my vernacular because it's been around me, and that's what they call it. I also know what white racism has done to African-American music, no matter what the genre.
Yeah.
Hello?
I think that's what he's relating to.
And I understand that, and because it's inevitable that it's going to seep into everything. We can go there with that. But when I say the word jazz, white racism is not something that I'm going to think or regard it as. When I hear the word jazz, I hear the word music that was created by African Americans. When someone else hears the word jazz, like Reverend Bowman, he knows the origin of it, so he has that aspect. Our perspectives are different, but that's only because I haven't delved to its origin. I remained in a place of my respect of that kind of music. So I see it as a name for that kind of music. He sees it as a name propelled and perpetuated by people who didn't care and were hateful. I'd rather see it the other way. Not that I disregard or ignore that. I know full well what that is, but for me, that's superficial compared to what it really is. Mm. Not what it means to somebody else. Give a shit, don't have the time.
Yeah.
The Reverend is there to let them know and to not let you skip or lie or hide behind what you done. And I respect that greatly. He's able to do that. I don't have time. I don't care what you've done. I only care what I'm doing and make sure it's not stepping on your toes. My learning to respect you, my learning to love you, despite your being you, what you have a right to do, be as hateful as you need to be as arrogant, be as hurtful as you need to be. First of all, you're not going to hurt me because I'm not going to stand in your way. Secondly, I'm not going to give you that power. Secondly, you're only going to experiment on yourself first, which means you're going to get the bulk of the pain of hating me because you're going to sleep every night on your pillow hating me. I'm not thinking about you at all because you're hateful and I don't have any room for hateful. So your hatred, your hatefulness, your definitions of me are absolutely useless to me and therefore not regarded by me. See ya. Goodbye. I move on very fast. It's not because I don't care. It's because I care about myself.
If we return to jazz music as the art form, which it is, and the significance and importance it has for our society, how would you see the way this type of music has developed from the time where it started until now?
Say 20 years from the time that we agree or recognize that it actually started. It evolved, but it was thick in its origin. So its evolution were more limited than when it grew 40 years, 60 years, 100 years, etc. So I believe that was that. But with my limited knowledge of its history, but completely immeasurable respect for its being, Gillespie, bebop, you know, and Weather Report fusion, it's developed and evolved into lots of different things. Granted, because of the variants of jazz that I'm familiar with, I get a lot of my jazz influence from Wynton Marsalis' Jazz at Lincoln Center in New York. I think that the percentage of its predominantly old school is high, and the percentage of its new school fusion and evolution is less. So when you regard jazz, you regard it as being a certain thing, where there is a branch that grows, grim branches that grow out of jazz that are almost not recognizable to the originals or the stereotypic thing you think of when you say jazz music. And for me, that's sort of reflective of all musical genres, even old school country, depending on the ethnicity and culture, old folk music, you know, the original music that the folks just sang from their heart, you know, oral tradition music, stuff like that. That's evolved too. Every genre of music has, but, and more than likely what's mostly regarded stereotypically when you say that word will be thought of as the way it was when it was originated.
Let us go to human rights activism, which I know is an important part of what you do. So would you be willing to share a little bit?
Sure. realizing myself as an activist came when I was introduced to an organization in New York founded by a former fashion photographer. The name of the organization is Positive Exposure, and I started working with them in the early 2000s by being asked to sing at the Smithsonian Institute when America celebrated the complete mapping of the human genome. They presented their collection at the time they were dealing with folks with albinism because of the stark genetic difference. But they knew I was a performer, and they invited me to come and perform at the celebration. It was wonderful and auspicious, and I had a chance to meet thousands of people with albinism because many, many attended. And it helped me realize that even though as I grew in my life, I knew myself as a human. I have feelings, I have desires, I cut, I bleed, I like everybody else, I'm happy, I'm joyful, I have my favorites like everyone else. So I knew my humanity through that common thread. Having albinism basically helped me to know the minutia, the majorities, the marginalized peoples, because of their stark diversities, how those humans that I knew myself to be were marginalized, and it changed my focus or added to my focus of wanting to at least proclaim the equality, validity, and substance of being. Like I said, being an African American, my skin is supposed to be brown, incredibly brown, because my parents were really chocolate and beautiful. But it is not. My nose is still African. My lips are still of the African genetic. My hair is still kinky, dreaded. All the things that Black people in America can do. But my skin does not. My hair color does not. Which meant that I lived a life understanding the depth of my being through seeing the things that I did have in common with other people. As long as you have that as a part of your being and existence, you are in my family, you're human, you're a loved one. So with albinism focusing in on my specific condition, I could speak and proclaim about being marginalized, because it was never really about being different as an albino, but it was about being deemed different and treated differently because of whatever you were, short, gay, tall, smart, anything that would cause people to want to ostracize you and justify the ostracization, I could be an activist towards. So I speak about albinism as a person who can speak about that, but my message as an activist and my stance as an activist is broader, because it's really about being.
What is the norm? Who's setting it? Why is it even there?
Basic, fearful, and ignorant people, whether they're your neighbor next door who speaks that way, or it's your mother who just can't see or can't accept, or your grandma, or your colleague at work, or your fellow musician, anyone you're engaging in, they accept or reject stereotypes of people who are opinionated. And when those stereotypes are wholeheartedly negative or unfairly positive, it's basically coming from people who are uninformed and therefore afraid. So I'm inspired to speak anytime I'm confronted with that and I have something to say. Now, they're what I would judge as ignorance in their stereotypes and malinformed opinions are their right to express. But, I make my living expressing. I can express the fuck out of shit. So go ahead and say what you have to say, but I am activated by what you say to respond or not. And in my activation, if I choose to respond, will be from an activist point of view, which is the wholehearted definition of the word.
Yeah.
I work with the UN. I work with this organization, Positive Exposure. I speak for International Albinism Day. I give lectures to people about their capabilities and about what albinism is all about. I give consultations to folks with albinism who are going through instances and difficulties, trying to offer a positive perspective, in lieu of them not having one at the moment, which is why they have issue with something or another. That is how I define my activism, and I've been exercising it ever since I realized that it may be necessary to lend my voice to that.
Let's talk about the album Lum, which you released in 2017, which was created especially for healing purposes through sound. What can you share about the idea behind the album and also the process of making it?
It started when a friend of mine who lives in the south of France, who owns a tea company, her tea leaves come directly from China by a tea master, and she thought that it would be good to combine her tea with some music for salons and places of peace and meditation to enjoy, so they could have the package of the tea, which she promotes, and the music, which I can do. So she invited me to join her in an effort, and we even flew to China together to present it for the first time. That was a wonderful success and an amazing experience. But Lo is for Laurence Marquez, who is the person who is the tea connoisseur, and she has a tea company in the south of France, and M for me, because that's my nickname. And we took the acronym LO, which is her nickname, and M, mine, and combined it to make Loom. And it defines the product we made from the tea and the music, Living Om, and I provide the muse part. So it's Living Om Muse. And I released it in 2017, but I'd done it a few years before. I released it as an album, and I also released it as a podcast. And it, from the podcast, it ended up being a meditative track for many people who reported that they use it when they're at the gym or when they're just chilling out at home after a hard work week. And I've really come to see that promotion is important, and that the artistic intent was really, really valid and really, really needed, and especially now.
Could you describe how it actually works? How do the frequencies take an effect on, let's say, the body or the psyche?
Well, it's a collection of 1 hour musical pieces specifically made in a certain frequency. And the first frequency that I dealt with in 2017 was the heart. So that's 528 hertz vibration, which affects your heart, healing, nurturing, and soothing one's heart psychologically through their listening to the music of waves going into their ear. Gold is the color that I chose for the frequency, but the heart chakra is green. It works in this specific way. It may work in other ways, but that has yet to be reported to me. It was intended to work by way of you enjoying the natural teas the Madame provides through her tea company, and you listening to the music while you're enjoying that tea and having that music literally affect your heart waves, your loving waves, and all that the heart chakra represents and does. And so aligning the frequencies to your chakras, meaning I have six other compilations that go with these six other chakras, that basically do the same thing. Those frequencies affect that aspect of your being, bringing vibration and light by way of hearing the music and relaxing your anxiety by way of drinking the tea.
Okay. Yeah.
The tea is called Yamaya, Y-E-M-A-Y-A. And it's wonderful, by the way. It's absolutely an incredible way to enjoy green tea from China that is exquisite in taste and absolutely healthy in benefit. And then listening to music that is not about a language or words or concepts, just beautiful sounds that flow to you and through you to help relax you like the tea does.
If we now go back to 2020, I would like to ask you, like, what are the projects you are working on right now?
Because of COVID-19, I have become an amazingly avid live streamer. So live streaming techniques, I'm perfecting and developing a style of my own. I've created a live stream concert series based on me working with my friends around the world, including you, Maestro, and creating concerts out of my home conveniently. I am becoming an author. I'm writing a book. I'm working on my next opera called Mon Electromagnetisme, which is my electromagnetism, which also happens to be M-E-M. I'm not a narcissist. It just turned out that way. I promise, I promise, I promise. Well, maybe not, but that's what I'm doing as well. I am enhancing my graphic artistry and my filmmaking, which is great fun. I am doing a podcast. Thank you, Amin. And I am perfecting the craft of jumping from Mac to PC. Oh my God.
That's probably the most difficult one.
That's crazy. I'm becoming a gaming programmer, so I'm building games, but I can only really do that on a PC. So I'm on it then, on PC for that, and then I'm doing the music for my upcoming opera and such, so I'm on the Mac, and then I'm doing filmmaking, so I'm on the PC and the Mac, so I'm going back and forth, back and forth. It's insane, but I'm loving it.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about the live stream?
Well, first of all, let me create and present a disclaimer to your audience. The next few words are going to be wholeheartedly and passionately filled with expletives. So watch out, or, you know, come back in about 3 minutes. But I was fucking tired of spending money doing concerts and not getting the proceeds in return or even breaking even. And the last time I went out and spent an exorbitant amount of money to do a concert and didn't get the proceeds back the way I thought because the attendance wasn't there, I said, fuck this. And so when I came home, I decided I was going to learn about this live streaming shit. And so I learned. I was invited after I had learned, and they didn't know about it, but I was invited to do a concert for a festival that I've been participating in for years called Lady Got Chops Jazz Festival out of New York, which features lady jazz professionals. And after having already made that decision, I wasn't going out anymore. I asked if she minded if I live streamed it, because I'm not just about to spend any money and I don't want to move. So she said yes, and I began to prepare a concert with a friend of mine who invited me onto this festival, a trumpet player by the name of Meg Montgomery, and she's been throughout my music for years. I asked her if she wouldn't mind, instead of trying to commandeer a club in New York City, because she lives in upstate New York, if she wouldn't mind just sending me green screen files, and I showed her how to green screen. And let's do it online as a live stream. So because I was in the middle of learning how to program for games, I used some gaming software that is used for live streaming gameplay and put together a concert of her and I. 9 songs, literally a 2-hour concert, and streamed it online. Before that, I can remember now, when I decided never to go out again because I was having a fit, I tried to do a Valentine's Day, February festival of my own work for my second opera, Femme Fractale. And I had invited my violinist and my bass player, who came out with me for the live concert, to do the live stream with me. We were trying to figure out how to do it real time, but they sent me video, and I did the actual real-time singing. That didn't work out so well because the latency was at least 8 seconds atrocious. It was horrible. I'd open my mouth to sing, and 8 seconds later you heard what I was singing. So everything was behind my movement. It was awful, but it taught me something. So when the jazz concert came around, I knew I was going to have to pre-produce. I pre-produced it, and it was phenomenal because not only can you green screen people to get the background out, you can take green screen free video footage of a flying carpet and knock the green out, and then that person would be on the flying carpet. You could literally put together a visual story. So I'd have a story visually to go along with my concert as I performed it, and I started live streaming that way. So since then, I've created a live stream concert series called Sound Vision, and I'm moving forward with that. I do one concert a month, and I try to make it as fantastical as I can because I'm in the green screen world. So you have something to see that provides the same vibration of fantasy as the music does, as we jam in whatever genre happens to be available, including avant-garde at the time. But because we're all quarantined, it becomes a captured audience and a great way to provide new, fresh content to the mix of what people need right now for their hearts and souls and minds. So I'm avidly practicing that and becoming a heck of a filmmaker in the process.
Okay.
But the next one I do, I'm going to do in VR.
Okay, so that means there's a lot of more coming.
Yes. Because I don't want to go out and spend money trying to do a live concert, although I love the energy of live concerts. Yeah. First of all, because of the circumstances, I don't really have a choice. And second of all, it's so much less expensive.
But now that you have mentioned it, maybe we can talk a little bit about live performances.
Yes.
And not only the live performances, but also the aspect of traveling. Firstly, as someone who had the huge luck to be in the position to be able to play concerts with you in the past, I mean, what I can say is, like, you know, out of the many, many, many I have played over the years, those ones have a very special place in my memory.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, that is the case for various reasons. So if you could talk about what the live performance does mean to you personally, and you know, how you perceive it and how you approach going out on stage and singing in real time in front of an audience?
What I want to offer my audience, the people who care to even be there to accept what I have to offer, is love. And I've learned, because of live performances with different people, a collection of people, all kinds of people, is that it has to start on stage first. So I have to work with people who are loving and know how to love, and people who are not fearful and don't practice love. The fearful brings on the disrespect and the inconsideration and the selfishness. And I've learned that that's not what I prefer. So live concerts these days, or for a long time now, has comprised of people who are loving. Not just love me, but are loving people, and I find loving, and I can vibe with. And even though you may be a massive master at what you do and would like to work with me, if I don't have that vibration with you, I can't work. I can't be my best, and I can't give my best. So my live concerts, due to a number of instances that have happened in the past, have been concerts where I'm playing, literally playing with my loved ones. You know, whether they're related to me or not, they are my loved ones. They love me. They love people. It's not just that I'm special. And sometimes you can get confused because the person treats you nicely. That means they're a nice person. No, if you see something wrong with them and they're treating others, guarantee you will be susceptible, because that's what's coming from that person. Has nothing to do with your specialness. But I find that live concerts are especially wonderful when the people gathered on stage presenting and expressing are loving people, and the people in the audience get that. And even if they're not in such a good mood or it's not so nice usually, that vibration overwhelms and it flows through the audience, and everybody really gets that loving vibe and practices that loving vibe, you know, at least until they walk out of the front door of the club and they go back to normal.
Yeah, but some maybe also take it with them. And it stays.
Yes, absolutely. I've been responsible, or been told I've been responsible for a lot of marriages and a lot of pregnancies.
I would say that's a pretty good thing, isn't it?
Yes, that's what I mean. It's not bad. It's a win-win situation. So I've also had the lovely, honorable, noble, kind, and overwhelmingly huge pleasure of hearing people say, my friend told me to come to the concert. I just got home from work. I wasn't feeling like it. I was tired. I was depressed. I was miserable. The last thing I wanted to do was go out, get dressed, and see a concert of somebody I don't know. I'm so glad I listened, and I'm so glad I came. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And as an artist who cares about how you feel and how they feel, that's a wonderful thing for someone to tell you. Yeah. And I've had the honor of having that told to me more than once. So I know that my gathering together and having fun on stage with the people that I'm collaborating in my expression with is the first point to a good concert for me, and the worth of doing it live.
But how do you see the aspect of traveling?
Honestly, as a child, you dream about traveling to different places, and then you grow up and you just dream about stability. But the first time I had the opportunity to travel, I really loved it. It was a new, wonderful place with wonderful people and a loving vibe, and I just had a blast. I've always loved to travel, and actually, fortunately, I haven't had travel in as a heavy rotation to which it would become a drag. So it's still exciting to me after so many years of being a practicing musician and having the invitation to go to places. It's still wonderful. It's still exciting. It's not boring. It's not dull. It's not a drag because, you know, you have so much luggage or this, that, or the other, or missing planes or any of that. I've been blessed in all those respects. So I would love to travel. I would say, though, I really, really need to get to Africa. So I just put that out in the world, and it'll come when the time is right. But that's one place I really, really need to get to, want to so much get to the continent and just experience it one time.
Yeah.
I have a friend, Salif Keita from Mali, who's promised time and again, but we just haven't been able to connect.
What does time mean to you?
At this point, absolutely nothing. And I'll tell you why. Think about it yourself. I keep bringing us back to the now, but it is what it is. It used to be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You know, whatever language you speak, it was always that. The 7 days of the time measured as a week. Now, given the circumstances, it's today, 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 today.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and the scientists say it's not linear. It's stacked on time of itself in different dimensions, different time. So time flies when you're having fun. Time slows to a crawl. You know, time stops when you're watching a pot boil. You know, all of the sayings. But in all of our sayings, we've described time differently. But experiencing it as today, 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 yeah, it gives you a perspective on what time is, really. And that's kind of what it was already meant, always meant to me, because I never did anything traditionally. So I really rarely ever had a reason to regard the watch or the calendar unless I was doing someone with someone else who was on a schedule. Then it's okay, I know how to march that tone. But most of the time it's like free flight. It's now, 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 now. I'm calling up people at 3 o'clock in the morning because I didn't bother to check the watch and see what time it was. But I was animated and awake at that time. So I call them and I go, oh shit, hang up real quick because it's 3 a.m. But I didn't realize.
Yeah, and especially right now, I mean, I had over the last couple of weeks, I had very often this situation where I was talking to someone and they said like, oh, today it's Wednesday. And I go like, oh, really? I didn't notice because I don't know, like, I don't know what day is today.
The sun is up, the sun is down, the sun is up. It's really that simple. And it's a fucking travesty that we have to be attacked by something, supposedly, you know, how it's happening. But it's also freaking amazing how you learn what really is, what really counts, what really exists, what really is going on. And nobody as a collective, nobody, none of us have had a chance as an entire planetary collective, to which I regard this instance as a galactic event because it's planetary. Had a chance to stop the shit, stop, just full on boom, break, stop. And that, when has it ever happened? Never.
And in the way what's happening now is something which, I mean, many may have thought about for a long time, thinking that, you know, we need to slow down, we need to stop. But we didn't before, so now we're forced to.
And also there have been instances where the conditions were coming where we thought it was going to happen. Remember Y2K?
What does money mean to you?
Oh my God. You asked me that in the day of cryptocurrencies? Really? Really? That's kind of what it means to me. There's the fiat, there's the crypto. Make your choice. I got some pebbles in my back pocket in case you trade that still, you know? Couple fire sticks? What do I? I got some rocks. I think they call them diamonds, but, you know, they're still rocks. That's what money means to me. It means trade. Or the middleman to trade. That's basically all it is. I mean, look, you can have all the money in the world right now and it means nothing if you're sick.
Now we have talked about, like, about the past, we have talked about the present. So if you try and think about the future, are there any like dreams or wishes or things you would like to manifest which did not happen yet? I mean, you named one already, being the wish to travel to Africa, but maybe there are some more.
Well, my dream to travel to Africa is probably a thing on, I think about it, dream about it, study it, am engaged in it a lot, although I haven't physically been there. So that's sort of a fantasy situation that isn't attached to time, because future is a time frame. I'm enjoying it now in my mind. And when I get there physically, I'll have that aspect to go along with what's in my mind and what was in my mind that will change once I arrive there physically. But it's almost like I'm already there. So in the terms of the time frame of what is to come, as I think of what I might want that I don't already recognize that I have, nothing comes to mind. The most important things that I would want are already here. I have love. I have a dedication, a job, which is to fulfill my dedication, great, great friends who are loved ones, invitations to openly and freely express how I feel, like your invitation to speak with you now about these things, food that makes me healthy and happy, children around me to remind me that it is as simple as that, elders around me and about me who help me to know shit hadn't changed in 60 years. The calling of the beauty and harmony that I am reminded of, whether I think of a new melody for something or whether I'm hearing an old melody of something in the past which inspired me back then. I have all of it. I guess if I aspire to the future of anything, it would be more of it, or even a deeper understanding, which would lend itself towards gratitude and appreciation of it. So I'll notice it when it's in front of me faster and appreciate it and love it and take care of it because I recognize it faster and deeper. I'd like that.
Since we have now arrived at the end for our conversation for today, would there be anything you would like to share with our audience to conclude the today's episode?
Hello, world. My name is Memnahad, and Armin Alech has my heart because he is, period.
Thank you very, very much for taking the time and for giving the both of us the opportunity to have this wonderful talk. It was a huge pleasure to me. And let's say we can do it again in like 2 years from now and see what, and see what has happened since.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Okay, well, thank you, Armin Alech, for inviting me to speak to you and to open up to you and be honest with you and enjoy you in your process and inviting me on this beautiful stage. And I definitely will have stories for you in 2 years.
What?
That was Talking Spirits number 2 with Memnahad and Armin Alech. For all things M, please visit www.memnahad.com or check out the links in the blog post for this episode at www.talkingspiritspodcast.com. In episode number 3, which you can already listen to right now, my guest is the German guitar player, composer, producer, label host and sideman Hanno Busch, and it will be an episode in German language. Thanks a lot for staying with us and listening. Feel free to reach out if there's anything you want to share with me or if you would like to become a talking spirit. Have a nice day, stay healthy and take care.